Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Bill Walton. Today, I will be reading from the June 2024 issue of The Atlantic. We'll start today's program finishing the article from last week titled, The History My Family Left Behind, written by Co Bragg, A Gun, A Lynching, and An Exodus from Mississippi. After we studied my grandmother's map of Mississippi, Auntie brought out another artifact, a collection of typewritten pages titled, Till Death Do Us Join. It's a document my grandmother composed to memorialize our family's Mississippi history sometime after her mother died in 1978. I imagine that she sat and poured her heart out on the typewriter she kept next to a window just outside her bedroom. According to Till Death Do Us Join, my family remained in Edwards for another generation after Bob Broom's death. Ike Broom stayed near the place where he'd almost been killed and where his brother's murderers walked around freely. Raising a family in a place where their lives were so plainly not worth much must have been terrifying, but this was far from a unique terror. Across the South, many black people facing racial violence lacked the capital to escape, or faced further retribution for trying to leave the plantations where they labored. Every available option carried the risk of disaster. A little more than a decade after his brother was murdered, Ike Broom had a daughter, Della. She grew up on a farm in Edwards near that of Charles Toms, a man who'd been born to an enslaved black woman and a white man. As the story goes, Della was promised to Charles' son, Walter, after fetching the Toms family a pail of water. Charles's white father had provided for his education, though not as generously as he did for Charles's Harvard-educated white half-brothers, and he taught math in and served as principal of a one-room schoolhouse in town. Charles left his teaching job around 1913, as one of his sons later recalled, to go work as a statistician for the federal government in Washington, D.C. He may have made the trek before the rest of the family because he was light enough to pass for white, and white people often assumed he was. He was demoted when his employer found out he was black. Still, Charles's sons, Walter and his namesake, Charles Jr., followed him to Washington. But leaving Mississippi behind was a drawn-out process. Edwards was still home, and D.C. their place of business, my grandmother wrote. The women in the family remained at home in Edwards. World War I sent the men even farther away, as the Toms brothers both joined segregated units and had the relatively rare distinction, as black soldiers, of seeing combat in Europe. When the men finally came back to the States, both wounded in action, according to Till Death Do Us Join, Della made her way from Mississippi to Washington to start a life with Walter, her husband. Grandma Victoria's letters says that Della and Walter raised her and four other children, the first generation of our family born outside the Deep South, in a growing community of Edwards transplants. Her grandfather, Charles Sr., anchored the family in the historic black community of Shaw, where Duke Ellington learned rag, and Charles Jr. would build a life with Florence Letcher Toms, a founding member of the Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Inc. Occasionally, aunts would come up to visit, sleeping in their car along the route because they had nowhere else to stay. The people mostly flowed in one direction. Victoria's parents took her to Mississippi only two times. According to my mother, Victoria recalled seeing her own father, whom she regarded as the greatest man in the world, shrink as they drove farther and farther into the Jim Crow South. Later, after receiving her undergraduate degree from Howard University and a Ph.D. from Northwestern University, Victoria joined the faculty at Tennessee State University, a historically black institution in Nashville. During her time there, efforts to desegregate city schools began a year-long crisis marked by white supremacist violence. Between her own experiences and the stories passed down to her from her Mississippi-born parents, Victoria knew enough about the brutality of the South to want to spare her own children from it. As a grown woman, she had a firm mantra: don't ever go below the Mason-Dixon line. Her warning applied to the entire hostile South, as she called it, though she made exceptions for Maryland and D.C., and it was especially true for Mississippi. Keeping this distance meant severing the remaining ties between my grandmother and her people, but it was a price she seemed willing to pay. My mother recalls that when she was in college, one of her professors thought that reestablishing a connection to Mississippi might be an interesting assignment for her. She wrote letters to relatives in Edwards, whom she found while paging through my grandmother's address book. But Victoria intercepted the responses. She relayed that the relatives were happy to hear from my mom, but there would be no Mississippi visit. It was almost like that curtain, that veil, was down, Mom told me. It just wasn't the time. Yet, reading Till Death Do Us Join, I realized that maintaining that curtain may have hurt my grandmother more than she'd ever let on. She seemed sad that she only saw her road-tripping aunts on special occasions. Our daily lives did not overlap, my grandmother wrote. Sickness or funeral became occasions for contacting the family. Death had its hold upon the living. Why could we not have reached into their daily happiness? I sensed that she valued this closeness and longed for more of it, for a Mississippi that would have let us all remain. But once Victoria had decided that the North was her home, she worked hard to make it so. While teaching at Tennessee State, my grandmother had met and married a fellow professor named Robert Ellis. He was a plasma physicist, and they decided to raise their four children in New Jersey, where my grandfather's career had taken him. My grandparents instilled in their children, who instilled it in my cousins and me, that you go where you need to go for schooling, career opportunities, partnership, even if that means you're far from home. My grandfather was one of the preeminent physicists of his generation, joining the top-secret Cold War program to harness the power of nuclear fusion and then running the experimental projects of its successor program, the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, after declassification. His work has become part of our family lore as well. My mother has her own mantra: same moon, same stars. It appears on all of the handwritten cards she sends to family and friends. I have it tattooed on my right arm. It signifies that no matter how far apart we are, we look up at the same night sky, and our lives are governed by the same universal constants. The law of physics, of gravity, inertia, momentum, action, and reaction apply to us all. In 2011, when I was 17, Victoria died. She'd suffered from Alzheimer's, which meant that many things she knew about Mississippi were forgotten twice, once by the world, and then in her mind. Auntie and I shared our regrets about missing the opportunity to ask our grandmothers about their lives, their stories, and their perspective on Mississippi. But Victoria's prohibition on traveling south also passed on with her. The year Victoria died, my mother took a job in Philadelphia, Mississippi, as one of two pediatricians in the county. Two summers later, she started dating the man who became my stepfather, Obie Riley, who'd been born there before a career in the Coast Guard took him all over the country. Mom and I moved quite a few times throughout my childhood, but this relocation felt different. I was surprised by how quickly Mississippi felt like home. Yet the longer we stayed, and the more I fell in love with the place, the more resentment I felt. I envied the Mississippians who'd been born and raised there, who had parents and grandparents who'd been raised there. I'd always longed to be from a place in that way. My stepfather has that. With a rifle in his white pickup truck, he spends his Sundays making the rounds, checking in on friends and relatives. He'll crisscross the county for hours, slurping a stew in one house, slicing pie in another, sitting porch side with generations of loved ones. This is what we missed out on, Auntie told me in her dining room. If our family hadn't scattered, we would better know our elders. To keep all my ancestors straight, I refer to a handwritten family tree that my grandmother left behind. I took a picture of it when I was at Auntie's house. Every time I zoom in and scan a different branch, I'm embarrassed by how little I know. The distance pushed people apart, Auntie said. I think there is some strength from knowing your people, some security. The traditional historical understanding of the Great Migration emphasizes the pull of economic opportunity in the North and West for Black people, especially during the industrial mobilizations of the two world wars. Certainly, such pulls acted on my family, too. The lure of better jobs elsewhere, as my grandmother put it, gave Ike Broom's son-in-law the chance to make a life for himself and his family in Washington. But this understanding fails to explain the yearning that we still have for Mississippi and the ambivalence my grandmother had about shunning the South. Mississippi had its own pull, even as violence of the kind visited on Bob Broom made life there grim for Black families. A 1992 study by Stuart E. Tolney and E.M. Beck indicated that a main predictor of migration by Black people from southern counties before 1930 was the cumulative number of lynchings in those counties. The collective memory of those lynchings was a force that compounded over time. Hope and despair commingled for my family, as it did for so many others. As the physicist in my family might describe it, these forces worked in tandem to push my ancestors north and tear them from the South. Only after I learned the details of Bob's death did I feel that I truly comprehended my family's path. In returning to Mississippi, my mother and I were part of a new movement of Black Americans, one in which hundreds of thousands of people are now returning to the states where they'd once been enslaved. I think of this reverse Great Migration as a continuation of the original one, a reaction, a system finally finding equilibrium. I feel like we moved home to Mississippi to even the score for the tragedy of the lynching in 1888 and for all that my family lost in our wanderings after that. We returned to the land where Diella Broom hurried between farmhouses fetching water, where Charles Toms ran the schoolhouse. It took well over a century for my family to excavate what happened in Edwards, buried under generations of silence. Now we possess an uncommon consolation. Even our partial imperfect knowledge of our Mississippi history, gleaned from my grandmother's writing and from newspaper coverage, however ambiguous it may be, is more documentation that many Black Americans have about their ancestors. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, commemorates lynching victims. It is the nation's only site dedicated specifically to reckoning with lynching as racial terror. Bob Broom is one of the more than 4,000 people memorialized there. I've visited the memorial and the steel marker dedicated to those who were lynched in Hinds County, Mississippi. 22 reported deaths, standing in for untold others that were not documented. Although those beautiful steel slabs do more for memory than they do for repair, at least we know. With that knowledge, we move forward, with Mississippi as ours again. and that article, titled "The History My Family Left Behind," was written by Co Bragg, who is an editor and a writer currently based in New Orleans. This next article is written by Adam Begley and is titled "The Wild Blood Dynasty: What a Little-Known Family Reveals About the Nation's Untamed Spirit." American Bloods, what a title. Hammering out agreement on the meaning of American is hard enough, but factor in blood, our precious bodily fluid, susceptible to poisoning in the fevered fascist imagination, and a brawl might just be brewing. If you've figured out that blood is a surname, the subtitle of John Keg's new book, The Untamed Dynasty That Shaped the Nation, could possibly diffuse the situation, but it too is provocative. If the blood dynasty shaped the nation, why have we never heard of it? Keg, a philosophy professor at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, lives in a house on the banks of the Concord River that was built in 1745 by a colonial named Josiah Blood. A decade later, in that same house, Thaddeus Blood was born. He was at the scene with a musket on April 19, 1775, when the shot heard round the world was fired. As an old man, he was interviewed about the experience by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Keg saw that the Blood clan would offer him a chance to explore big ideas in relation to individual lives, to start close to home and expand outward, weaving together personalities, cultural history, and philosophy in an attempt to ask not just where we came from, but where we're going. Keg sets out to trace the nation's growth and excruciating growing pains as refracted through one of America's first and most expansive pioneer families, whose lineage happens to run straight through his family home. Listed in the index of a privately published genealogy, he finds in his house are thousands of Bloods, from Aaron to Zebulon. In addition to Josiah and Thaddeus, Keg plucks out a handful of others, curious characters born between 1618 and 1838, who found themselves in the thick of roiling history or crossed paths with famous American thinkers. Naked opportunism guided the first figure in Keg's book, Thomas Blood, who was not American, but is the most notorious individual to bear the name. In 1671, he tried to steal the crown jewels from the Tower of London. A rogue as well as a thief, Thomas sets the tone for the American branch of the family, which was started by his nephews, who were among the early New England settlers, arriving sometime in the 1630s. By mid-century, Robert Blood had established a farm on a 3,000-acre tract just north of Concord, then very much the frayed edge of civilization. A troublesome man, Robert was a good citizen when it suited him, and a renegade when taxes fell due. He nonetheless understood that the best defense against external threats was neighborly cooperation. The wary dance he did with local authority, in Keg's telling, presages in miniature the political dynamics as the colonies began to rebel against the British crown. The old favorites Emerson and Thoreau, transcendentalists who championed American cultural independence and the primacy of the individual soul, take the stage as Keg fast-forwards roughly a century to focus on Blood's intersecting with homegrown ferment. Robert's great-great-grandson Thaddeus made an enduring impression on Emerson, who admired the rare courage that the veteran of the skirmish at the Old North Bridge had displayed as a young Minuteman. Keg suggests, though certainly doesn't prove, that Emerson's conversation with Thaddeus in 1835 was the catalyst for what he calls Emerson's own acts of insurrection. Two speeches delivered in the next several years, The American Scholar and The Bombshell, Divinity School Address, in which he renounced all organized religion, and in particular what he elsewhere derided as corpse-cold Unitarianism. James Clinton Blood, a co-founder and the first mayor of Lawrence, Kansas, and a passing acquaintance of John Brown, whose gory attacks on militant pro-slavery settlers helped give Bloody Kansas its name. James had gone west as part of an abolitionist scheme to keep the territory from becoming a slave state, and acted as an agent and a scout, buying up land from native tribes. He survived the Lawrence Massacre of 1863, when Confederate guerrillas killed some 150 unarmed men and boys, and in the post-war decades happily watched the frontier town civilize itself. James is meant to be representative of the many Bloods who participated in the settlement of the American West and who came to understand the border as a paradoxical space where the most vicious of beings could also be the most vulnerable. I don't know whom CAG is referring to in that last clause or what he means. He's keenly aware that we can't contemplate the bleeding of Kansas unless we reckon with the war fought over the moral abomination of slavery and also the genocidal persecution of the native population. In earlier chapters, he mentions a few of the enslaved people bought and sold by various 18th century Bloods, and here he describes the dismal fate of the Plains tribes who were cheated out of their land or driven off or simply exterminated. We never learn, though, whether James' land deals were made in good faith or how other untamed Bloods fared on the new frontier. This seems the wrong moment to fudge. The stories we tell about how exactly the Wild West civilized itself color our ideas about who we are as a nation. American Bloods is not a panoramic intellectual history or even a conjoined narrative. CAG has assembled a series of portraits, some more engaging than others, the degree of interest determined by which great men are adjacent to the male Blood in question. At one point, he alludes to what he calls a largely forgotten counter-narrative, the Blood Women. But his only substantial contribution to that counter-narrative is to present us with the charismatic women's rights advocate Victoria Woodhull, who married Colonel James Harvey Blood, a veteran of the Union Army and a committed spiritualist. CAG calls Woodhull arguably the most famous and scandalous of the American Bloods, and it's perfectly obvious why he would want to adopt her. Extreme and mercurial, she's an ideal embodiment of many divergent, unconventional responses to the trauma of the Civil War. Victoria met James in St. Louis in the mid-1860s. 26 years old and strikingly beautiful, she was working as a medium and a spiritual physician when James consulted her, seeking treatment for wounds suffered in battle. She fell into a trance and announced that their destinies were linked. James liked the idea. Obeying the spirits, they left St. Louis and their spouses behind. The new marriage lasted barely a decade, but it was some decade. In New York, the soothsaying of this blood by marriage morphed into investment advice, lapped up by an aged Cornelius Vanderbilt, and Victoria made an utter fortune from her wildness, as CAG puts it. She founded a brokerage house and a crusading weekly newspaper and waged energetic campaigns for free love and equal rights. CAG concedes that Victoria's methods as a healer and fortune teller were fraudulent, which is to say, too wild for belief. Having toured this gallery of untamed beasts, exhibiting so many different shades of American wildness, we might ask what wild means to CAG himself. I'm not sure, but it's clear that's one important step in his quest to make space for the contradictions and tensions and paradoxes of daily life, has been coming to terms with Benjamin Blood, a promiscuously talented poet-philosopher. Benjamin's rhapsodic mysticism, eccentricity, and primal vigor were particularly appealing to William James. This blood taught Cag's hero that the secret of being, in James's words, is not the dark immensity beyond knowledge, but at home this side, beneath the feet, and overlooked by knowledge. A practical idealist, high-minded yet of the people, he's been called a mystic of the commonplace, Benjamin was born in 1832 in upstate New York. Over the course of his 86 years, he was an inventor, a gambler, a gymnast, and a boxer, as well as a poet, metaphysician, and a compulsive writer of letters to the editor. In short, the antithesis of a library-bound thinker. Dissatisfied with philosophizing, he told James that he felt compelled to go into more active life, to work 10 hours a day in a local mill. "I have worn out many styles," he boasted, "and am cosmopolitan, liberal to others, and contented with myself." His intellectual pursuits, Cag writes, should be regarded as an afterthought to action, the trace of a life lived as fully as possible. Cag warmly welcomes the idea of the incomplete, of a cobbled-together and eternally unfinished worldview. He finds it frustrating, but also encouraging. At the same time, he can't resist imposing an overarching unity. Eager to wrap things up neatly, he claims that Benjamin Blood's philosophy of an open-ended, open-hearted pluralism and of active engagement in the wider world somehow silently guided the Blood family from its very inception. And yet the thought of the whole crew, from Thomas to Perez to Victoria, all wedded to a single ethos, hardly sits well with Benjamin's belief that the genius of being is whimsical rather than consistent. What does this have to do with America? Cag is telling us that wildness is with us always, yesterday and today, even the dangerous, corrupt, fraudulent varieties, but that beneficent wildness makes room for exploration, new ideas, new ways of being. A more perfect union is always possible, though ever not quite. Now, that article titled The Wild Blood Dynasty was written by Adam Begley, who is the author of Updike, as well as The Great Nader, The Man Behind the Camera, and Houdini, the Elusive American. And that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June 2024 issue of The Atlantic. I'm Bill Walton. So long, until next time.